This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.
We're obviously at a premium for space. I've closed off the class now. I'm not allowing anyone else in since we're oversubscribed. And we're going to begin. So I'm Dr. Elliot Malamet. We're closing the doors, please. I'm going to ask everyone to turn off your cell phone, please, or turn it to silent. I'll wait. The silence and the seeming unresponsiveness of God to circumstances of profound and innocent human suffering is one of the central problems of Judaism and any Western religion. It surely contributes to grave doubts and even spiritual crisis among religious believers. Now, from the perspective of Jewish philosophy, the question is not so much why do bad things happen to good people, but rather how can a supposedly all-loving and all-powerful God allow for the presence of evil and suffering in the world. Theodicy is the term that philosophers use to talk about justifying God's goodness in view of the existence of evil. And it may very well be that there are no answers to the dilemmas of theodicy. You're thinking, I want my money back. but I think it is actually crucial to examine the strategies that are offered to supposedly solve, quote-unquote, this problem. And these explanations, as it were, tell us a great deal about the negotiations that we all make with regard to the maintenance of our own religious beliefs. So in this talk, I want to briefly, which really on one foot, present and analyze some of the important theodicies employed in Jewish thought, both ancient and modern. There's a series of questions that attend to this. What are we willing to overlook in order to protect God or God's reputation? What is a deal breaker for faith, if anything? Whom or what are we willing to blame for the presence of suffering? Now, throughout history, the presence of evil is constantly erupting into human life, from antiquity to last week. With the subsequent question of where was God when all of this was happening, when innocent people are caused untold suffering. In the first half dozen sources in your source sheet, the problem of divine silence is given particularly anguished expression. From the ancient sources that you see in 1 and 2, Sefer Iyov, where Job cries out to God and says, I cry out to you, but you do not answer me. I stood and you just ponder or contemplate me. To the book of Psalms, awake, O Lord, why do you sleep? Rouse yourself, do not reject us forever. Why do you hide your face and forget our misery and oppression? We are brought down to the dust. Our bodies cling to the ground. Rise up and help us, redeem us because of your unfailing love. To more modern examples, heartrending examples, here's a book by James Lehan, who's an Episcopalian priest in the States who does a great deal of counseling in sexual and family abuse cases. Here's a prayer of a sexual abuse survivor. You said you were the God of the universe. Were you the God of the people within it? Were you not the one who frees us from abandonment? I was abandoned, frightened, helpless, alone. Where were you, God? I needed you. You were not to be found. In my loneliness, my heart sank. Why did you hide your face from me? What offense had I done to you? And scratched onto the walls of Mauthausen, if there is a God, he will have to beg my forgiveness. Now, when you talk about evil and suffering, it can be looked at from two different ways, and I don't mean to belittle it from a non-religious point of view, but frankly, from a secular point of view, the fact that there's evil in the world is horrible but not inexplicable. You say to yourself, people do terrible things to one another. Nature is nature. Tectonic plates shift and cause tsunamis. Cells mutate and cause cancer. And that's how it is. Or as the Buddhists would say, blank happens. But from a religious point of view, it's entirely different. And it's interesting that somebody who had no investment in the matter, the French philosopher Albert Camus, was actually acutely aware of this in his book L'Homme Révolté, The Rebel, in source number 5, where he says the only thing that gives meaning to human protest is the idea of a personal God who is created and is therefore responsible for everything. Only a personal God can be asked by the rebel for a personal accounting. Right. So, this is summarized very aptly, the religious problem, the irreconcilable religious problem, by the Scottish philosopher David Hume, who was an atheist, who writes in his Dialogues Concerning Natural Religion the following: is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Then he is impotent. If he is able but not willing, then he is malevolent. And if he is both able and willing, then how is there evil? Right? This triangle of thought, theodicy, that God is all-powerful and all-good, and yet somehow evil still exists, is a central religious problem. How can these three things work together? If you think about it, after the Shoah, which is the time period that seems to preoccupy most people in the modern world, even though terrible things have happened to many, many people throughout history, but it's understandable, as we'll talk about later, that the newer troubles attract our attention. So then the problem becomes exacerbated. Richard Rubinstein, the American thinker and writer, writes his book After Auschwitz in 1966. I think it is instructive to think about the position of Jews after the Shoah in terms of talking about the Holocaust. We now, in 2017, are used to years, decades of discourse about the Shoah, books, poetry, films, museum exhibits, March of the Living, Yad Vashem, on and on and on. But if you go back 50 years, longer, 60 years, and you think about the situation of whether people were talking about the Shoah in the late 50s and the 60s, the situation is very different. One striking piece of data, when Elie Wiesel publishes Night, first in Yiddish and then in French, it bombs. Nobody buys it. It has terrible sales, and there's even a question about whether it's going to get printed again. And slowly, through the quirks of publishing history, which we won't get into here, it picks up steam and is now known globally. But people don't want to talk about the Holocaust. It's much too raw, much too difficult. And theologians certainly don't want to talk about it. Right? So Rubinstein writes the following in the early 60s, when nobody is writing about it. And he says the following: how can Jews believe in an omnipotent, beneficent God after Auschwitz? Traditional Jewish theology maintains that God is the ultimate omnipotent actor in the historical drama. It has interpreted every major catastrophe in Jewish history as God's punishment of a sinful Israel. Let's pause there. He is, of course, correct. Traditional Jewish texts, their go-to, default theodicy, is punishment for sin, right? We saw it last night, of course, when we read Eicha, and we see it in many texts. This comes as startling, disturbing, shocking to moderns, but it's still true, right? Rubinstein is just connecting the dots, following the thread. He is saying, you know, when I look to Judaism for help in these matters, you know what it tells me? That not only is God not absent, but he's there, and he's actually punitive. He's saying, you messed up, and so I'm punishing you. And if that is the case, argues Rubinstein, why shouldn't I apply that to the Holocaust as well? And so he says the following: I fail to see how this position can be maintained without regarding Hitler and the SS as instruments of God's will. To see any purpose in the death camps, the traditional believer is forced to regard the most demonic, anti-human explosion in all history as a meaningful expression of God's purposes. The idea is simply too obscene for me to accept. Right? So there he breaks with traditional theology and says, I'm not convinced, and if this is the way Judaism looks at the matter, then I make my peace with God. I'm not going to buy into that. But of course, what you're left with, as he continues, is something quite great when he says, we live in the time of the death of God, I mean that thread uniting God and man, heaven and earth, has been broken. We stand in a cold, silent, unfeeling cosmos, unaided by any purposeful power beyond our resources. After Auschwitz, what else can the Jews say about God? Well, of course, a lot. Actually, Jews do say a lot about God, and not just this. But it is a stark reminder of the fact of when you feel you've come to a dead end with theodicy. So we're going to kind of walk our way back from that dead end and take a look historically at what people tried to do with the problem that Rubinstein thinks is somehow unsolvable. One possibility is to simply say, well, there really is no such thing as evil. And even though this seems very counterintuitive and hard to sustain, it was mentioned and talked about throughout Jewish history in a variety of ways. In other words, what we call evil is really just the absence of good. And this is really the argument that Maimonides puts forward in The Guide of the Perplexed, in the third book, in chapter 10, when he puts forward a version of that. In other words, it's like much less scary to say the absence of light than it is to say the word darkness. So when the Rambam tries this idea on for size, he thinks about the first chapter of Genesis where it says, "Vayar lekim et kol asher asah v'hineh tov me'od," that God saw everything that he did and it was very good. And Maimonides learns from this that God creates only good, and therefore evil is simply a lack of good. What Maimonides calls, borrowing from Aristotle, a privation. Same word as deprivation. It's just a lack, just an absence. And therefore God is not capable of creating evil, and evil is just an absence of God's creation. That is the theory that he's trying to expound. And it is a kind of neat philosophical formulation. But it does feel removed from the experience of many human beings, where evil and suffering seem real and palpable and like something you can touch and sense. It has a visceral presence. Some of you might recall Lewis Carroll in his 1871 novel, Through the Looking Glass. There's a scene, he has a kind of whimsical take on this whole issue. There's a scene where the king is talking to Alice, and he says to her, "Just look down the road and tell me if you can see either of them." And Alice replies, "I see nobody on the road." And the king remarks fretfully, "I only wish I had such eyes to be able to see nobody and at such a distance, too." And that idea is actually part of the way existentialists think about nothingness, that it isn't just an absence of something. It is a something. That there is a presence to nothingness. There's a wonderful scene, this is now going back, I'm dating myself, but there's a wonderful film by Ernst Lubitsch called Ninotchka that came out in 1939 with Greta Garbo and Melvin Douglas. And there's a scene, and Garbo is a kind of worker, she's a kind of socialist, communist kind of worker, grim, unsmiling, never laughs, and Douglas constantly trying to get her to laugh. So he tells her the following joke. He says, "A man walks into a restaurant and sits down and asks a waitress for a cup of coffee with no cream. The waitress answers, 'Oh, I'm sorry, sir. We don't have any cream available. Can it be coffee without any milk?'" Garma doesn't laugh at the joke, but I think it's a great joke, actually, because it is reflecting a certain point of view in the 30s and 40s about the idea that things that aren't have a presence, right? Sartre actually puts it better in Being a Nothingness. He has an example. Let's say you have a friend, and the friend, let's call him Pierre, and you walk into a restaurant because you've arranged to meet Pierre, but you are 15 minutes late. So you come into the cafe, and you're aware of a lot of things. You're aware of lighting and music and smoke, but these are all background, because what you're really aware of is not Pierre. The not Pierre, the fact that he's not there, the absence of Pierre, has a something to it. What Sartre calls an absence that haunts the cafe, right? So the nothingness is actually something we experience. Analogously, I think for many people, evil and suffering are not just a lack of good. There's something that is there, that haunts the scene of life, that's real and palpable. It's not just a clever trick where you have a lack of something. So after the Holocaust, Jewish thinkers definitely move away from this Maimonidean formulation. And just to give you an example of two of the main ones in sources 8 and 9, Rav Soloveitchik, in his essay called Odi Dofek, says the following: Judaism, with its realistic approach to human beings and their place within reality, understands that evil cannot be obscured, and hidden evil is an undeniable fact. There is evil, there is suffering, there are hellish torments in this world. And whoever wishes to delude himself by diverting his attention from the deep fissure in reality by romanticizing human existence is not but a fool and a fantast. Right? So no flinching away from it. Don't come to me with this like fancy footwork that there's no evil out there. There is. What's really courageous and interesting about it, since Rav Soloveitchik is a very traditional Orthodox thinker, is that he's not willing to just sort of buy God time by putting out an absence of good argument. He says, we've got to face what it is. It's terrible. Terrible things happen, and if you don't feel that way, you're either very foolish or you live in a world of fantasy. But I'm not going down that route. And Eliezer Berkowitz in 9, similar sentiment when he says the evil that created the ghettos and the death camps and ruled them with an iron fist was no mere absence of good. It was real, potent, absolute. So if we're not going to invoke this idea that somehow evil is not what it is, we have to go back to the beginning and create strategies or responses to suffering. So I've tried to break these down into 5 categories. The first one is the one we alluded to before, which I call the strategy of self-criticism. And here we're saying that evil is literal and it's a potent force in life and that God allows it to be manifest in the world. So how do you salvage God's goodness? And that was a real dilemma for the sages of the Talmud in the wake of the destruction and even pre-Talmudic times. That was their Holocaust. It was the devastation left by the destruction of the temple. I often feel this is sort of misdiscussed. It isn't just the knocking out of a building. You're talking about loss of sovereignty, lots of dead people, starving people, exiled people. It is devastation on a huge scale. So one strategy which informs Talmudic texts and also prayer book is the idea of self-blame. Right? And you can see that very clearly in a very oft-quoted passage in number 10 from the Gemara in Yoma, right, where it says, why was the first sanctuary destroyed? Because of 3 things which prevailed there: idolatry, immorality, bloodshed. But why was the second sanctuary destroyed, seeing that in its time they were occupying themselves with Torah, mitzvot, and the practice of charity? Because there prevailed sinat chinam, hatred without cause. In the Musaf Amitav for Chagim, we read, Mivnei chataenu galinu meretzenu, because of our sins we were exiled from our land, right? So what's the mentality that underlies a theodicy of self-blame? I think that if we think about this somewhat psychologically, there's an emotional hallmark, right, of maturity, which is the ability to tolerate ambivalence. The tendency that some people have to forge very rigid binary categories that place everything into right or wrong, black or white, is characteristic really of childhood, of an earlier stage of development. Kids are like that. But if a person can't stand the tension of competing realities and truths, things are complicated and messy. Life is messy. If a person can't stand that clash, the mixed picture, then they prefer to kind of force a certainty, whether it's illusory or damaging. And maybe that feels preferable to living with the ambivalence of reality. You see a very powerful expression of this in Ronald Fairbairn, who was an influential psychoanalyst, lived and worked in Scotland, was born there, and published his central works in the 30s and 40s and 50s. And in one of his papers, Dr. Fairbairn writes the following, source 12. It's better to be a sinner in a world ruled by God than a saint in a world ruled by the devil. A sinner in a world ruled by God may be bad, but there's always a certain sense of security to be derived from the fact that the world around is good. And here Fairbairn, who worked with very traumatized children, teenagers, expresses the emotional reality of a child whose world of authority and sustenance and nurturance is run by the adults in his life, and so in the face of, let's say, harsh, neglecting, or just unpredictable treatment by those adults, parents, that child, in his childish black and white conception of things, has to choose, so to speak, who's going to be the bad one? Who's going to be the sinner? Is it going to be me, or is it going to be the parental world around? And he chooses himself or herself. Why? Well, if children are neglected by their parents, especially when they're young, through abuse or sheer incompetence or indifference, they can't simply replace their parents. They're forced to find a way to cope with this behavior. And as Fairbairn puts it, if a child's parents are bad objects, he cannot reject them, for he cannot do without them. As Jeremy Young writes, the child is thus in a conundrum. If he recognizes the badness of his parents, he's left alone in the world, without a sufficient source of attention, affirmation, and protection. In order to feel secure, the child has to imagine that his parents are good. And the solution to this problem is to blame himself for his parents' failures. Because this allows him to feel, firstly, a modicum of security, even if it's illusory, that the ones who are, so to speak, running things, who have the power over him, mean well and know what they're doing. Otherwise, the world, as you can imagine, feels very frightening, very unstable, and insecure. And secondly, it allows the child the illusion of personal control. Because if I decide I'm the bad one, then I can have the hope that if I act better, then things will get better for me. I can, therefore, have some control over my parental world around. And the alternative is intolerable, right? To live in a dangerous and terrifying world ruled by the devil, where there's no safety and no hope and no control, is an impossible scenario, even if you are the good one. So if that myth of the loving and concerned parent was exposed, the trauma would be overwhelming. The disappointment would be shattering for the child. Now, I'm not suggesting that there's any easy kind of one-to-one correlation between what Fairbairn is discussing about children and their parents and our discussion of human beings and God. But there is a parallel in terms of the quest to make sense of what frequently seems to be inscrutable and unpredictable in terms of God, and the strategies that are employed to cope. The covenant between God and human beings and the Jews seems to be based on mutual promises and expectations. If you think about just basic tefillah, the covenant holds the promise that if we do good, we'll get good. If you carry out a righteous life in which you adhere to God's mitzvot, then part of the Bible promises rewards of longevity, of prosperity, and so on. But this raised a very big problem for the rabbis after the destruction, which is the possibility that the contract doesn't follow a predictable pattern. That behavior might not be recompensed in the way you'd expect it. And that's the real trauma of the destruction. It's not just the falling of the building. It's the shattering of the contract, the expectation. We thought that if we behaved like this, we would get that. And we thought we'd behave like this, but we didn't get that. We didn't get a sustenance, a nurturance, a continuation of our life. We got destruction. So the question for them was whether God had held up his end of the bargain. And how do human beings reconcile their understanding of what is promised by God in this contract and the events that actually take place in history? How do we sustain the relationship, trust it, make sense of it, maintain faith, really, in the face of ambivalence. That was the fork in the road that the rabbis faced 2,000 years ago. Rabbi David Hartman, in his well-known 1985 work, A Living Covenant, lays out the parameters of the quandary very clearly. You'll recall that the Torah, in Kriyat Shema, actually, in the second paragraph of Kriyat Shema, Vayayim Shema Tishmu, says that if you carry out God's mitzvot, you will get rain in its season, and so on and so forth. Then things will be good, and if you don't, God will be angry, and it will shut up the sky against you, and so on. In other words, if we as Jews do our part, we'll be rewarded, and if we do good, we'll get good. So let's not think about it from the point of view of the Gemara. Let's think about it prospectively. You're living at that time. You think you're doing an okay job. You certainly don't think that you deserve a Holocaust. And then it comes. Now you're past it. You're looking backwards, retrospectively. So what you have to do now is ostensibly move in reverse, right? Where you have to fit the punishment to the crime. Since the events of real life suggest that we've been punished, working backwards, what the Talmud does is say, well, we must have failed in our commitment. So you see what's going on here. They flipped it around. They believed if we do good, we'll get good. We got bad. Therefore, we must have done bad. So let's take a look at Hartman and Source 13. The Bible and rabbinic literature attest that Jews failed to find direct, stable, and predictable connections between their behavior, whether as individuals or as a community, and subsequent events. When meticulous attempts to live up to covenantal responsibilities were followed by unexpected disasters, was it because of some undetectable flaw in apparently exemplary behavior? Was it because of the sins of earlier years or even of previous generations? What all this bespeaks is a sense of theological panic. You thought you understood how the world worked, or at least how religion worked, or at least how promise meets reward, and all gets blown up, and it's just frantic. What is going on? How do I make sense of this? So you start going backwards. Right? The way to think about this is just to think about it on a micro level. Think about people who are good people, who are treated badly. And sometimes those people, instead of calling it for what it is and saying so-and-so is a terrible person, they'll be on the phone with you at 2 o'clock in the morning and they'll be saying, what did I do? I think it's because I did this, right? And they pick out some minor, picayune, absolutely ridiculous point to somehow justify what the result was. Chazal are on the phone, and it's the middle of the night, and they are frantic, because this is the ball game right here. Is it a good God? Does the Bible make sense? Is it true? Does it say what it says? Does it mean what it says? And so a strategy evolved. I'm not saying it was a conscious strategy, and I'm not saying they didn't believe in it, but I am saying that it was a crisis that triggered this writing, which is to try and make sense of what he calls the connection between behavior and events. Rabbi Hartman concludes by saying one cannot ascribe a sense of dignity to people who are burdened by such questions and are unable to handle their understanding of how God responds to their lives. The rabbis were deeply concerned with this problem. And so are we. Right? So are we in our time. If the way people are and what they get in this world don't match in our opinion, then there's a theological crisis. We can do all sorts of things with it, suppress it, finesse it, explain it, but the crisis remains. For someone like Rabbi Soloveitchik, the crisis is unsolvable. And so what's interesting about his approach is that it is not to explain, it is to move forward. It is almost to put it in suspension, to say, you cannot stare at the sun, I will not be able to explain this, I'm not going to deny it. Right? So that was his earlier comments, I'm not denying there's evil, I'm not going to sit here and whitewash you, but I'm just going to say I don't know what to do with it. So that's kind of like the strategy of moving on, you know, that you see in Sources 14 and 15. Right? The mechanism of blaming yourself for your own injuries just adds insult to injury.
pour salt in the wound. He's not willing to do that. So a different approach is just to completely leave behind the question, why, and move to a different question, which is, what comes next? And in that strategy, you move forward, not back. Let's take a look at what he writes. Again, from Codex Didophic, which was written in the 1950s, in Source 14. What obligation does suffering impose upon man? We do not inquire about the hidden ways of the Almighty, but rather about the path wherein man shall talk when suffering strikes. Sorry, I think that's take. I think that's a typo. We ask neither about the cause of evil nor about its purpose, but rather about how it might be mended and elevated. How shall a person act in a time of trouble? What ought a man to do that he not perish in his afflictions? The halachic answer to this question is very simple. Afflictions come to elevate a person, to purify and sanctify his spirit, to cleanse and purge it of the dross of superficiality and vulgarity, to refine his soul, and to broaden his horizons. The function of halakha is to mend that which is flawed in an individual's personality. Halakha teaches us that the sufferer commits a grave sin if he allows his troubles to go to waste and remain without meaning or purpose. A couple of things just to note here. Number one, the only person who can do this is you. You cannot do it for someone else. You cannot say, this happened to you because you. You might be able to say to yourself, well, I'm thinking that this happened, I don't know why, but maybe I can make certain changes, which is a time-honored strategy in Jewish thought. He's not saying, by the way, it's very important to parse this subtly. He's not saying he deserved it. He's not saying it's quid pro quo. He's saying it happened. There's no way around that. And maybe the best you can do with this indigestible thing that's now eating up your life is just say, what can I learn from this? How can I become a better person? Without necessarily shouldering the guilt or the blame or saying, this was coming to me, but just saying, it is. It's an existential fact. What do I do about it? A slightly different iteration from Rabbi Harold Kushner. In 15, some of you recall Rabbi Kushner, conservative rabbi in Massachusetts, very fine man. Writes a book, When Bad Things Happen to Good People, in 1981, upon the loss of his son from a very rare genetic disease. The boy died, I think he was 14, 15, something like that. And he writes this to discuss suffering. And he says the following in 15, I don't know why one person gets sick and another does not, but I can only assume that some natural laws which we don't understand are at work. I cannot believe that God sends illness to a specific person for a specific reason. I don't believe in a God who has a weekly quota of malignant tumors to distribute and consults his computer to find out who deserves one most or who can handle it best. What did I do to deserve this is an understandable outcry from a sick and suffering person, but it is really the wrong question. Being sick or being healthy is not a matter of what God decides that we deserve. The better question is, if this has happened to me, what do I do now? And who is there to help me do it? It becomes much easier to take God seriously as the source of moral values. We don't hold him responsible for all the unfair things that happen in the world. Now, of course, this is a radical shift in Jewish theology because he's taking on frontally the idea of divine providence. So, sorry to say, what happens to you is just what happens to you. God's not involved. He doesn't send you bad things. It's fair to say, then, I believe, to infer from this that he doesn't send you good things either. So there's a feeling when I read Rabbi Kushner, A, I empathize, B, I understand the strategy, which is essentially what he's doing is to say that God is not all-powerful. Since he's cutting that part of Hume's dilemma, remember Hume talking about, you know, if he's all-powerful and he doesn't, you know, what's the issue there? Well, Kushner takes that on and says, well, maybe he's not. Maybe he can't. Maybe there's places in the world he just doesn't get to, things he can't control. But you're redefining God now. Right, you're redefining, for instance, the purpose of prayer. If I pray to a God and God can't do anything about it, it's kind of a funny thing, right? I'm kind of praying to myself. which may be useful, but it's not the same thing as a traditional conception of, say, Lishabeirach that was said on Shabbat morning. So Rabbi Kushner is pushing hard in one direction, and that's fine, but I always feel that when somebody does that, one has to critically analyze the outcome, the repercussions, the resonance that's left behind. This is a very different kind of God here. So one could start out and read the first few lines and feel completely empathic. You know, this idea that God is somehow shooting down an illness for some unspecified reason is disturbing, unsettling, doesn't seem right somehow. But there's a price to pay, obviously, for the position that he's expounding here. But what is similar in both what he wrote and what Rabbi Soloveitchik wrote is the idea that the better question is, what do I do now? Somebody who took this and really, in a way, put it on steroids is Professor Emil Fackenheim in Source 16, what became famously known as the 614th commandment. He says, we are first commanded to survive as Jews, lest the Jewish people perish. We are commanded, secondly, to remember in our very guts and bones the martyrs of the Holocaust, lest their memory perish. We are forbidden, thirdly, to deny or despair of God, however much we may have to contend with him or with belief in him, lest Judaism perish. We are forbidden, finally, to despair of the world as the place which is to become the kingdom of God, lest we help make it a meaningless place in which God is dead or irrelevant and everything is permitted. To abandon any of these imperatives in response to Hitler's victory at Auschwitz would be to hand him yet other posthumous victories. This became a kind of rallying cry for federations across North America. Right? Don't hand Hitler any posthumous victories. I was much younger when I first read this. I didn't like it then. I don't like it now. I think it's actually pretty shabby philosophy. And I am not fond of rallying cries that are based on negation. I don't think people should be lighting Shabbat candles because Hitler hated us. And I think it was a short-term kind of popular thing, and it is already in the rearview mirror because that's not the way it operates. Jews don't do things like that anymore. Rabbi Sacks actually had a very trenchant critique in an earlier book from 1990 in Source 17. The Holocaust did not make Jewish survival a mitzvah. In the Holocaust, for example, gypsies too were singled out. That didn't make it a command to be a gypsy. We could imagine hypothetical Hitler who decreed a final solution against homosexuals. That would not, of itself, sanctify homosexuality. Jewish survival has religious significance after the Holocaust only because it had significance before the Holocaust. But that's what happens when you take the ball of let's go forward and run with it, and run with it really, really far without reckoning where are we running to and why. Right? Michael Wishegrod, the professor of Jewish studies, great thinker actually, in 18 says this rather starkly. He's really attacking here this very disturbing impulse in contemporary Judaism to whip up Jewish identity through consistent reminder of the Holocaust, as if the Holocaust is now the feel-good of our time and we're going to get everybody to be Jewish because of the Shoah. And he says, I do not think that Judaism can be given a new hold on life by means of Auschwitz. For me, the Holocaust was a totally destructive event which makes my remaining a Jew infinitely more difficult than it has ever been. There's no salvation to be extracted from the Holocaust. No faltering Judaism can be revived by it. No new reason for the continuation of the Jewish people can be found in it. Right? So there you have a really seminal dispute that took place over the last few decades about whether the right approach to this is to just think forward or even to go further and use it as a springboard for further identity. And this continues to take place, really, because it is in relationship to the massive rates of assimilation around the world, but especially in America, for Jews, and whether suffering, perversely, can be used as some kind of cog in the continuity machine. Let's turn to a different and more serious philosophical approach, the idea of human freedom, which is put forward most famously by Eliezer Berkowitz in Source 19 and following. Berkovitz writes, God's involvement in the realm of finite reality is imaginable only as an act of self-limitation, as it were. God, notwithstanding his transcendence, bends down into the world of finitude, reduces himself so that he may enter into the narrow straits of relationship with finite existence. So the first component here, based on the Kabbalistic notion of Tzimtzum, is that God contracts so that he can enter into our reality. But that's not where it stops. In sources 20 and 21, Berkovitz takes this much further. And he writes in his book, Faith After the Holocaust, such is God. He is a God who hides himself. Man may seek him, and he will not be found. Man may call to him, and he may not answer. God's hiding his face in this case is not a response to man, but a quality of being assumed by God on his own initiative. That's an important sentence. And the reason that's an important sentence is that when the Bible talks about God hiding his face, if you look in Dvarim Lamed Aleph, it talks about it as God's angry response to Jewish betrayal. But Berkovitz does not talk about it like that. He does not talk about it as a punishment. He talks about it as an existential reality. That's the facts of the cosmos. That for us to be, God's got to get out of the way. That the hiding is not a kind of fit of pique by an immature divinity, but rather it is something God has to do so that we can operate. He expands on this in 21 and says it is the tragic paradox of fate that God's direct concern for the wrongdoer should be directly responsible for so much pain and sorrow on earth. If man is to be, God himself must respect his freedom of decision. If man is to act on his responsibility without being continually overawed by divine supremacy, God must absent himself from history. But man, left to his freedom, is capable of greatness in both, in creative goodness and destructive evil. God himself could eliminate moral evil and the suffering caused by it only by eliminating man, by recalling the world of man into nothingness. So this is a cogent argument. I don't find it persuasive, but I like the fact that it is consistent and that he's working it through. He's arguing that God's silence or hiding is not a punishment. It's a condition of human freedom. And that if God were to curtail freedom and prevent us from doing evil, then by virtue of doing that, he would also prevent us from doing good. So what the free will defense, first of all, does is it completely distances God from the moral problem and from the evil in the world and away from history itself. So without free will, there could be no moral goodness. A world without free agents would be morally void. That's what he's arguing. The question is whether the good that comes with allowing human freedom outweighs the bad, that is, the existence of moral evil. Consider the scale on which moral evil has occurred, even in recent history. Is this too high a price to pay for freedom? That's a question I throw out. Or could God not have created free agents without risking bringing such radical moral evil into the world? In other words, he makes us free, but not totally. There are physical limitations that humans have. Why not certain kinds of moral limitations? Another criticism of the free will defense imagines a human being using it to justify his failure to intervene to prevent a crime from being committed. You're a parent. You're at the park. You're there with your, your son or daughter when they're little. Think of your children. Think of them when they were little. And you go away, your five-year-old daughter, and you go away for 10 seconds to throw something out in the rubbish bin. And out of the woods jumps a rapist, murderer, horrible person. And they do horrible things to your child, and you refrain from intervening because you say, I need to respect their freedom to act. This is a very serious critique of the free will defense. When we say Avinu Malkeinu, I sometimes think to myself, I don't know that I would treat my kids that way. So the free will defense is powerful. It's important. It's not complete, of course, because it doesn't talk about things that humans can control, disease and geological disaster and so on. So it's limited to the domain of what people do to other people. But even in that domain, it's worth a vigorous critique. It's worth thinking about these analogies. And of course, the counter defense to this has always been, your ways are not my ways, God is different, you can't compare, you can't analogize. That's fine. That kind of freezes the conversation. After all, what is one going to say to that? But in rational terms, I think that there is a problem if you say you could have prevented something and you don't because you want to protect the free will of the evil agent, we would be judged to have made a severe moral error in those circumstances. So the question is, if that argument is unacceptable concerning a human being, why is it acceptable coming from God? I'm going to leave that as a rhetorical question. I certainly don't have an answer for that, but I do think it's worth thinking about when people invoke the human freedom idea. Fourthly, the re-envisioning of God in the covenant. In this strategy of theodicy, which is quite modern, you're not explaining, you're not talking about human freedom, you're actually saying to God, okay, it's a new world now. What you've done has created brand new circumstances. It's almost like somebody who's been cheated on, right? And they say to their partner, I'll stay with you, but I feel no obligation to do so. I'll do it voluntarily, but there's stuff on the table between us now. And so whatever happens now is because I've engaged in a kind of voluntary covenant with you. And that is Rabbi Irvin Greenberg's position after the Holocaust, what he calls the broken covenant, which he got from Elie Wiesel, but also the voluntary covenant that he talks about. We'll get to that in just 1 minute. Prior to that, I just want to go back to Rabbi Kushner for a moment, because he and Rabbi Mordechai Kaplan, who you may recall is the founder of Reconstructionist Judaism, are really the first people, certainly in modernity, to talk about God in a brand new way, that is, a God who is not all-powerful. And I think in doing so, they want to restructure the relationship of human beings to God. They don't want human beings to give up on God, they want human beings to think about God differently. Like, I can't always look to you for everything. You're a different kind of partner now. Rabbi Kaplan actually talks about this before the Holocaust in his book, The Meaning of God in Modern Jewish Religion, which came out in 1937. You see a brief snippet of this in Source 22. He writes, "Modern man cannot possibly view earthquakes and volcanic eruptions, devastating storms and floods, famines and plagues, noxious plants and animals as necessary to any preconceived plan or purpose. There's simply that phase of the universe which has not yet been completely penetrated by godhood." I'm not sure I understand that sentence, actually, but I think it's a kind of poetic way of trying to say that God is not all-powerful, hasn't gotten everywhere. He's honest enough to recognize immediately what this entails for Judaism when he says, of course, this involves a radical change in the traditional conception of God. It conflicts with that conception of God as infinite and perfect in his omniscience and omnipotence. And picking up on the same strand of thought, Rabbi Kushner writes in 23, God wants the righteous to live peaceful, happy lives. But sometimes even he can't bring that about. God is not perfect. There are some things God does not control. Our misfortunes are none of his doing. I can worship a God who hates suffering but cannot eliminate it more easily than I can worship a God who chooses to make children suffer and die for whatever exalted reason. The last sentence is really the giveaway, right? He's telling you, this is the God I want. And if I have to make a choice between the all-powerful and the all-good, I'm going to choose the all-good. And I'm going to sacrifice God's power because I prefer that God to the one that's envisioned in the Bible. But, of course, the thing that gets sacrificed there is the traditional conception of God being infinitely perfect and infinitely wise. And it also changes very much the relationship that one might have with God if one seeks out such a relationship in terms of things like asking God for help, just on the simple kind of daily level. What would that mean in this conception? And so so Irving Greenberg puts forward the notion of a voluntary covenant, given all the circumstances that have occurred in the wake of suffering. In his essay, Voluntary Covenant, which is now 30 years old, he writes, "Since there can be no covenant without the covenant people, is not the covenant shattered by the Shoah? In Elie Wiesel's words, the Jewish people entered into a covenant with God. We were to protect his Torah, and he in turn assumes responsibility for Israel's presence in the world. Well, it seems for the first time in history, this very covenant is broken." Okay. Greenberg continues a few lines later. "Morally speaking, God must repent of the covenant, do tshuva, for having given his chosen people a task that was unbearably cruel and dangerous without having provided for their protection. Morally speaking, then, God can have no claims on the Jews by dint of the covenant. What then happened to the covenant? I submit that its authority was broken, but the Jewish people, released from its obligations, chose voluntarily to take it on again. We are living in the age of the renewal of the covenant. God was no longer in a position to command, but the Jewish people were so in love with the dream of redemption that it volunteered to carry on its mission." Now, this is a lovely thought, and there is what to it. I mean, so much of contemporary Jewish life is just chosen life. I think that is the definition of modernity, is to choose. But considering the massive rates of assimilation of contemporary Jewry, you have to ask whether the phrase that the Jewish people are in love with their mission is actually true. And ironically, and this strikes me, if it is true, maybe it's truest precisely among those who do not feel the covenant is voluntary, but actually subscribe to a traditional view of being commanded by God, that Judaism is obligatory. I think there's an enormous irony here. Right, which is I do respect the notion, I even somewhat subscribe to the notion that everything one does is in a sense voluntary and one binds oneself voluntarily. But it's often hit me that the people who remain connected and tied to Judaism day in, day out, decade in, decade out, are not those people who think it's just a voluntary covenant, but those people who feel they're obliged and commanded. So that is something to think about when considering Rabbi Greenberg's position. Having said everything we've just said, it's very clear that the most popular go-to theodicy, certainly for modern people, is what we might call incomprehensibility. Right? The reason that most believers like this is that it maintains both their own faith and it absolves God of guilt or blame. We don't understand why people suffer, God's ways are mysterious, and so on and so on. You see versions of this in sources 25 and 6. Of course, in Eov, which is all about incomprehensibility, the story of Eov, well known to you, is that he loses everything that a person can lose. He loses his wife, his children, his property, his money. He suffers terrible physical suffering, right? So it's a parable of what happens when you're stripped of everything. He is bitter and lamenting and complaining throughout the book. Does not feel he deserved it. We saw the opening of this talk, his lament to God in chapter 30. Why are you just sitting by? And unlike our lives, God pops out in person, makes an in-person appearance in chapter 38, but what he says when he appears may be less than fully satisfying, because it's really a version of shut up, don't question me. It has a slightly sinister, almost kind of godfather-like tone, which is when I read it, I think of Brando, you know. Who are you? What do you know? Nothing. Right? And that's what he's telling him over and over and over again. If you look in chapters 38, 39, 40, 41, right into 42, it's this consistent steamroller of don't ask, you don't know anything, right? Just a brief section of it in source 25, where were you? Or where were you when I laid the earth's foundation? Tell me if you understand. Who marked off its dimensions? Surely you know. Have you ever given orders to the morning or shown the dawn its place, that it might take the earth by the edges and shake the wicked out of it? Have you journeyed to the springs of the sea or walked in the recesses of the deep? Have the gates of death been shown to you? Have you seen the gates of the deepest darkness? Have you comprehended the vast expanses of the earth? Tell me if you know all this. And of course, right? Now, Job is comforted. Job is comforted because, I guess, any conversation is better than no conversation. So he at least has, and Buber talks about this, at least he has the comfort of knowing that God's actually there. He may not like the answer, but he's not just talking into space. But it is really putting forth a theodicy of incomprehensibility, meaning you don't know how stuff works, so don't say anything. And the question is, what the price is that you pay for that kind of negotiation? Rav Soloveitchik gives a similar look to it in Source 26. As long as man's apprehension is limited and distorted, as long as he perceives only isolated fragments of the cosmic drama and the mighty epic of history, he remains unable to penetrate into the secret lair of suffering and evil. To what may the matter be compared? To a person gazing at a beautiful rug, a true work of art, one into which an exquisite design has been woven, but looking at it from the reverse side. We, alas, view the world from its reverse side. So that's more incomprehensibility. So you say to yourself, good, that's where I am, that's where we all are, right? And default, that is where we all are. Even the most religious of the religious wouldn't go to a child's funeral, give a eulogy, and say it's because he was punished for sin. So that says to me that incomprehensibility has become the de facto theodicy of all contemporary Jews. But it isn't without a price. And I think it's very important to analyze what the price is, the psychic price of maintaining this in the face of continued suffering and evil. And it's put very well, if somewhat academically, by Professor Avi Sagi, professor of philosophy at Bar-Ilan. Sagi calls this epistemological impairment. Epistemology is the theory of knowledge, meaning what you know, and impairment, you know what impairment means. Means your knowledge is impaired, your ability to cognize is limited. Right? And he writes, the ability to know is limited and unable to grasp the all-relevant facts and all the relevant facts and all the pertinent moral considerations. That's the theory. We just don't know. What's the upside? Human beings can go on believing in God's goodness even if they don't exactly know how to reconcile it with moral iniquity. And then he pauses and he says, okay, it's maybe a fair trade, but you have to keep in mind two things. Number one, that the number of instances in which God's commands or God's deeds appear to be immoral is relatively limited. Because the higher their number, the lower the justification for continued belief in God's goodness. And two, the model's assumption is that what appears immoral is not really so. Only the limitations of the human cognition view it as injustice and evil. What seems immoral is dismissed in favor of a more important moral consideration, which is that God is good. If it eventually emerges that some divine acts are patently immoral, the justification for continued belief in God's goodness will be reduced. Let's take a look at this, right? He's saying that adopting this theory as your go-to for when bad things happen is not without a great price to pay for the believer in terms of the credibility of constantly invoking it as an explanation and also denying your own emotional instincts, right? And he offers two central problems with the incomprehensibility defense. The first is that the more often you need to invoke incomprehensibility with regard to God, the more it stretches belief that what seems incomprehensible is in fact only too comprehensible, that God has abandoned human beings to their fate, right? And perhaps a parallel to this would be if you had a friend and you saw her one day with bruises on her arm and a black eye, and it seems pretty plain that she's a battered wife, and you ask her and she offers an excuse. Either she says, I fell down the stairs, that's what they seem to say in the movies. Or, yeah, my husband did it, but it was just an accident, it was a mistake, whatever. Now, if you're the person on the other end of this conversation, 90% of you is thinking, no way. Or 99% of you is thinking, no way. So you take out the 1% and you say, all right, fine. You don't want to make anything of it. I won't make anything of it. We'll just say, we'll suspend judgment now. Okay? That's once. Now what happens if you see this woman 10, 20, 30 times over the subsequent years with the same thing? Are you willing to say, it's incomprehensible? I just don't know why that happened. I don't know why he did it. Because he's a good person. That's what Sagi is pointing out. He's pointing out that if it keeps happening over and over and over and over and over again, it creates a psychic pressure on the believer to maintain the incomprehensibility defense in place. It's not impossible, and we all do it. But you do it either by completely creating cognitive dissonance, not even thinking about the problem, or by thinking about it and just compartmentalizing it, wishing it away, putting it to the side, suppressing it. And every time it comes up again, it's challenging again. So the question for each individual believer is, how many times is enough? Or perhaps the answer is, it doesn't matter, because I've already made my decision about this, and so evil can keep on going over and over and over again, and I'm not going to challenge my belief structure. But if you're honest with it, the quantity of the amount of times should create a certain kind of dissonance within. That's the first critique of incomprehensibility. The second critique has to do with your own intellectual psychic structure. You have to unknow what you know. Right? What does it mean to say words that you would never say in any other domain of life? You'd be confident, you trust in your judgment, right? If it walks like an evil person and it talks like an evil person. So you can keep looking at these terrible things that happen to people seemingly without cause, without justification, and you can say, I don't know. But what Sagi argues is that maybe you do know, and you just have to keep, do a number on yourself and kind of not know what you know. Right? These are his two coins of, really just think about it as points to think about when you invoke this theodicy. There's a point and example, actually, there was a PBS special years ago about Holocaust survivors over the plausibility of simply invoking that God's ways are mysterious as a way of explaining suffering. And let's take a look at a brief transcript here. This was a program they did about faith in God after the Shoah in Source 2028. Mr. Menachem Daum says, at the Passover Seder, my mother would get annoyed as my father recited the Exodus story. She would ask him, if God did so many miracles during biblical times, then why hadn't she seen any such miracles during the Holocaust? My father's only response was that we humans, with our limited minds, cannot expect to understand God's ways. We must live with faith, despite our unanswered questions. The tenacity of my father's faith has always been a mystery to me. It's a lot easier for me to understand the religious defiance of my father's only surviving relative, his cousin, Dora. So now Dora comes on, and she says, I cannot see a God who will allow a little baby to be killed for no reason at all. And I really lost my belief then, right there and then. I had one sister and two brothers. I was the oldest and the only survivor of my family. Why? What did they do so terrible that they had to perish? I think if God is so great and so powerful, he could have struck Hitler down before he killed so many Jews. That's my feeling. But clearly, if you're invested in the tradition and you don't want to, you know, clearly don't want to insult people by offering some punishment for sin, theodicy, then most likely incomprehensibility is the only option. It certainly was for Lubavitcher Rebbe, we see in 29. Who was very upset when anybody would say people deserved what they got. He would say, the tragedy of the Holocaust is an unanswerable question. There's no human rationale whatsoever that can explain such indescribable suffering. Indeed, God's words to his prophet that my thoughts are not as your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, that is all that can be said. It's interesting that Sagi makes an important point about this business that I don't know anything. He says, well, if you don't know anything, let's take that one step further, as he says in Source 30. Supporters of this model that humans have extremely limited cognition can argue we don't understand anything. This claim, however, leads to a series of problems extensively discussed in the history of philosophy. First, if we don't understand anything, how do we know that God's understanding is greater than ours? If we don't understand anything, how can we claim that God is good, given that this claim requires some sort of knowledge, both concerning the good and concerning God's attributes? Be careful where you tread. Right. There are all sorts of intellectual questions around the corner. All right, so now I'm sure you're at this point now where you're all quite irritated with me. Why did you lead me down the garden path here, just spinning round and round? Indeed, where does all this leave us if all theodicies are provisional and somewhat lacking? I think that there are a couple of takeaways, at least for myself. First of all, I think the difficulty of asserting any all-encompassing or even partial explanation should leave everyone with humility and should leave religious believers with the most humility of all. Because it is believers who often are the ones who put forward the most strident pronouncements. But I think when you look at theodicy straight up, there's an ironic certainty of just how uncertain knowledge and understanding are. And that's an important thing to keep in mind. Believers need to understand just how easy it is not to believe. And that belief is not a black-white binary. It's a very complicated spectrum, and it's a continuum, and it's very difficult to explain to others. And those of us in the so-called religious community, that's an awful word, religious, just awful, need to keep this in mind always. The better to respect the viewpoints of our neighbors who might not share our religious perspectives, and not just relate to them in some patronizing or perfunctory manner. No one has a monopoly on the truth. And secondly, the next time you hear a teacher or a preacher lively discuss the relationship of God to suffering and evil and easily mouth some platitude like God hears all prayers, but sometimes his answer is no, I hope you'll examine their words with careful scrutiny. Everyone has a right to their opinions, but we've reached a state in Jewish discourse where people's beliefs have morphed into somehow unchallengeable dogmas, and that has to stop. One final thought before I close. About 9 or 10 years ago, there was an exhibit at Yad Vashem, I think it was in 2008, which documented at the time 60 years of Holocaust survivors' contributions to Israeli society. The exhibit displayed the achievements of survivors in all walks of Israeli life, literature, politics, economics, defense, settlement of the country, culture. Also, there was a special place for the visual arts, graphics, design, fashion, painting. Note the moving testimony here in 33 from Eliezer Ariyon, one of the survivors they interviewed. So here I am right now, he says, about 80 years old, coming to the year of 80. I have 2 married children, wonderful children. I have 5 grandchildren and 1 great-grandson. 3 generations born and raised from the ashes of the Holocaust. Today I am the happiest man in the world. Just last week I was thinking, my God, 62 years ago I came here, a boy of 17, from a different planet, into a different planet. I feel that I accomplished what I wanted, my life, my children, and grandchildren. I couldn't be happier in any other place. I'm always saying to people, the fact that I survived as a decent man and a believing Jew can laugh and love and look on the world's bright side is nothing less than magnificent. My whole life has changed, but my life is still a continuing defeat for Hitler and the Nazis who hope to destroy us. But Am Yisrael Chai. I would suggest that the word survivor does not do them justice. I've actually never been fond of the word. It infers that their life is defined exclusively by what they escaped or endured. But the reality is more complex and much richer than a single word implies. Survivors did far more than survive. Abner Shalev, who's the chairman of Yad Vashem, put it this way. There were 500,000 people who came here to Israel, established themselves without help from anyone, built the country with their own hands. The ability of those who remained after the Shoah was not just to survive, but to make an impact on the world. And so too, the existence of the Jewish people is nothing short of a miracle. And with all of the evil and suffering in the world, Jews have always focused on being a moral and creative force. The Talmud in Brachot on Yud Gimel Amud Aleph tells the following story. A person was walking along and a wolf attacked him, and he survived it, and he continued to relate the story of the wolf. A lion attacked him, and he survived it, and now he related the story of the lion. A snake accosted him, and he survived that, and he forgot about both the lion and the wolf, and he continued to relate the story of the snake. So too, the Gemara concludes it is with the Jewish people. More recent troubles cause the earlier troubles to be forgotten, right? In the original, Tzarot Achronot Mishachot Et HaRishonot. Jews in this country and around the world have an understandable tendency to worry and fret about what is in front of us, about our newest troubles, and that's understandable. But we forget momentarily that we have faced terrible trials and tribulations before. When I walk out into the streets of this city that I call home, Jerusalem, and see what has been built and continues to be built, and my mind superimposes a picture of the destroyed Jerusalem 2 millennia ago, I'm left nothing short of dumbstruck. If anything fills me with awe in this world, it is that. So if Jews are about anything, we're about faith in what can be, not just in what is possible, but belief in the impossible. Thank you very much.
This is a production of the Pardes Institute of Jewish Studies. For more original Torah content, visit elmad.pardes.org.